All right. So what I want to talk about today is I'm actually going to talk about the case of the Basel Accord. And what I'm trying to do with this case, though, is situated in a broader context of how to conceptualize the sort of overarching frameworks that have shaped the sort of new global financial architecture. And I come at this from a comparative and historical perspective. Actually, most of my research involves looking at the Bretton Woods system through archival data. I've spent some time in the archives of the OECD. And so while most of my talk is going to be about the Basel Accord, I'm going to, for the sake of time, focus on that because that's sort of the new thing. But I'm going to try to come back to how we can understand it in reference to the Bretton Woods system. I'll be also happy to talk about it further in questions if time allows. Now, the problem here that I'm trying to address is that on the one hand, we have these two things going on, that we have these proliferation of transnational institutions for economic regulation, and they seem to work. There was a period from, say, the breakdown of the Bretton Woods system through about the Asian financial crisis and the collapse of long-term capital management in the mid to late 90s that if we look at data on just a number of banking and currency crises around the world, they're just sort of going, there's a lot of them, and they're increasing since the 70s. And then actually after the mid to late 90s, they drop off quite a bit. And then, of course, a couple of years ago, that trend just ends dramatically, and we are now having a quite substantial financial crisis. So, oops, that was some terrible, oh, okay. So, why did the system fail so spectacularly? On the one hand, we had a harmonization of standards and practices, but what I'm going to argue is that the kinds of regulatory structures that were put in place, the institutions that were put in place, don't provide mechanisms to actually regulate macroeconomic processes. And this is something I'm going to again get to at the end, but this is actually something that I think the earlier post-war system actually did quite well. And one of the things that actually let it work a bit better, not perfectly, but a bit better. Particularly, we have a buildup of massive liquidity imbalances. At the same time that crises are sort of, you know, dropping off after the Asian financial crisis, there's this real turbulence going on, growing in global credit markets and global exchange, where you have these massive liquidity imbalances. And there's really no mechanism to address that. People are aware of this. People are talking about it. People are pointing it out, people who occupy very high policy positions, but there's really no mechanism to address this. And what I'm going to argue is that this isn't just a sort of an oversight on the part of some smart people or the result of some sort of a very localized political infighting, but the result of a broader trend. And what I'm going to try to argue is the neoliberalization of the regulatory system. And I'm probably going to overreach here in this talk because I'm making a broad claim using one case as an example, so I appreciate, of course, comments and questions about how this may or may not apply to other cases. Okay, so what do I mean by this idea of neoliberalization? Now, I'm sort of drawing on a literature that's moved away from the notion that neoliberalism means the retreat of the state, but actually is the result of these two competing pressures. On the one hand, states have not retreated from markets, but the way states can intervene in markets, there's been a sort of a delegitimation of state intervention, the kind of targeted, direct state intervention that we maybe saw under more Keynesian models of economic management have largely been delegitimated for a variety of reasons that I won't go into. But at the same time, as we know, there's always a continued need for state intervention. We know this from Polanyi. We know this from just the institutional scholarship on the sociology and politics of markets in general, that you can delegitimize the idea of the state intervening in markets, but markets inevitably need some kind of regulation. So the result of this tension, people have called the neoliberal dilemma, is not the retreat of the state, but the reconfiguration of forms of state intervention, the rearticulation of the relationship between the state, society, between the state and market, has three kinds of features. One is that policy increasingly becomes insulated from politics. So policy, it's not apolitical. It's still motivated by political interests, but the act of policymaking is moved into institutions that are protected or shielded from mass political participation. The second is that there's an increasing reliance on technocratic solutions to policy problems. And finally, the approach to regulation is market-centric. There's very strong market discourse about how regulation is going to take place and this idea of trying to find ways to help markets regulate themselves. So these three features are what I see as embodying a sort of a broader trend of neoliberalization. This has been used to describe trends going on in sort of various kinds of domestic policy reforms. What I want to do is apply this framework to the international regulatory setting, looking at the Basel Accord. So first, this first way in which Basel Accord and people at this point are probably pretty familiar, but I should probably actually sort of back up for a second and just give the quick sort of nuts and bolts of how the system works. The accord emerges out of negotiations in the 70s and the 80s. It's changed over the years. The basic idea behind it is to set an international standard for measuring what the riskiness of assets and then setting a standard for how much capital banks need to hold in reserve against the riskiness of those assets. And the Basel Accord is, in many ways, a sort of a great success of international regulation. It's developed by the rich countries, a small set of rich countries, in the 80s, and within a few years of them drafting what was a short, 30-page document, about 90 to 100 countries had signed on to it and made considerable steps to actually implementing it. But one of the ways in which the Basel Accord reflects this new neoliberal institutional structure is that it's built on and reinforces a homogeneous set of policymakers and regulators. It's really a banking and central banking regulatory program. I mean, these were the negotiators that were involved in the original drafting of the accord, at least directly. And it's not just that it's among central bankers, but among central bankers who, at the period that we're talking about for the 80s and 90s, are themselves becoming increasingly homogeneous in their views and practices. So we see this, for example, in the massive spread of something like inflation targeting as an official central bank practice. Inflation targeting to have an explicit policy to hold the line on banks doing it in different ways, some measure of the inflation rate, perhaps to promote economic stability. Others have argued perhaps to protect the value of financial assets. Now, the second is that if we look at the changes of the Basel Accord over time, there seems to be some evidence, and I've started to look at this, haven't really sort of analyzed it in great detail, but there seems to be some evidence that the views of private finance, the actual industry that the Basel Accord is supposed to be regulating, is favored in policy developments. We see this, for example, in various iterations of the proposal the Basel Committee for Bank Supervision would send out a draft proposal for comments and then would submit a new sort of rewrite the draft of what the new plan was going to look like. And, most of the people that are responding to these drafts and sending comments and then contributing to these new iterations, they're either bankers, central bankers, or people involved in rating credit instruments. In other words, they're the people that the regulation is supposed to regulate. And in some ways, this makes sense. I mean, they know what it is that the thing is about, and so they can actually talk about it. But you can, in other words, there's sort of this, we might call an epistemic closure, this insularity around the kind of development of the accord. And then finally, not only is there sort of a homogeneity or an epistemic closure of views around the accord itself, but the institution involved in drafting it and sort of has increasingly become independent from other state institutions and regulatory structures. So along with the spread of inflation targeting, and in fact the two were seen as part of the same coin, we see the spread of central bank independence as a formal, official doctrine. And so first, Basil Accord moves and is also built upon a kind of organizational insularity where direct politics from sort of outside institutions does not really happen. The second is that, particularly over time as the Accord was developed, involves technocratic solutions to what are really political problems. Now, the first way we see this is that the very first draft of the Basel Accord, the very first accord, was really very simple. I mean, it was like a 30-page document. And it had this very simple plan, this sort of one-size-fits-all model for regulation. There's five different kinds of assets. They get these five different assessments in terms of riskiness, and everybody just applies them. Well, over time, people felt that this didn't work for a variety of reasons. There were some perverse unintended consequences. Banks complained that it didn't actually capture the true risk of the assets in their portfolio. So what they moved to, what the Basel II system, the real sort of redrafting, substantive redrafting of the Basel Accord, is the internal ratings-based approach, where banks would use their own mathematical models to assess the riskiness of their portfolios. These would be sort of double-checked by one of the approved credit rating agencies. And this is now how the riskiness of the portfolio of bank assets would be measured. Well, this, of course, requires the development and understanding of complex mathematical models. To move to the internal ratings-based approach, you need to be able to do this sort of thing. You need to have access to the expertise, the tools, to develop the models themselves. And the Basel II system actually gave you a great incentive to move to this approach. If you could move to the internal ratings-based approach, typically you needed to hold less capital in reserve than if you were using the old one-size-fits-all model. So there was a real incentive to move to this kind of system. Okay? So this means that discussions about credit markets, how much credit's in the system, how risky is it, this now becomes a technocratic problem. You know, we just need to find the right model, capture the right variables, weigh them the right way, and then we'll sort of know how the system really works. And then finally, the Accord explicitly was designed to set up a framework, but to delegate the actual practice of supervision and regulation to the actual private market actors themselves under the supervision of some domestic regulator. But the Accord was never really designed to be this supranational kind of monitoring system. They were going to put the framework in place, have some checks in there where you'd have to show that you were meeting some basic standards, but the real nuts and bolts were going to take place at the domestic level and were really going to be managed by the private market actors themselves. And again, fitting with what I'm calling the neoliberalization of market activity. Put some regulations in place, but then leave it to private market actors to actually carry out the implementation, of those regulations. So this quote, for example, comes from the draft of the Basel II framework from 2006. Okay. Now, to get a handle on really the sort of the broad features of I'm calling this a sort of a neoliberal framework, if we compare this to the Bretton Woods system, so I'm looking in particular at meetings of a particular working group within the OECD that was meeting to discuss issues of balance of payments adjustments. And if we look at those meetings, we find a very different thing. One is that there's a much broader participation in these discussions. Now, I'm not going to go so far as to say that this is a sort of a mass participatory organization. You know, these are still political elites, but they're political elites or state representatives from a much broader array of state institutions. So if we were to look at, you know, the American delegation, It's the Treasury. It's somebody from the Federal Reserve. But it's also somebody from the Council of Economic Advisors. Occasionally, it's somebody from the Commerce Department, right? People from different state agencies who respond to different sets of institutional pressures, different interests. We would see the same thing in the French, the German, any one of the European delegations, four or five representatives from a, you know, let's say fairly broad array of state institutions. The second is that discussions of balance of payments, you know, was undertaken at an incredibly low level of technical sophistication. I mean, one balance of payments was just very, very hard to measure at the time. So my favorite example of this is there's one meeting where they're trying to figure out what's going on with the American balance of payments deficits. This is in 1961, I think. And the size of the category, they're looking at this data, and there's one category that's just errors and omissions, right? Things that have moved, but we don't know where they came from or what they are. Well, errors and omissions was the size of the entire American balance of payments deficit, right? There was as much error as there was actual knowledge. So this may sound like a terrible thing, right? How can you have a discussion if you don't know what it is you're talking about? But the upshot of this was that it then meant that you just couldn't turn into these endless discussions of like technique and technocratic management. What it really became about was politics. What do we want these numbers to mean? Right, so there's one meeting where Robert Rusa, who was Undersecretary of the Treasury, he went to a lot of these meetings, is complaining that the Europeans won't count payments for American military bases as part of the positive side of the American balance sheet. And what he's really complaining about is who's going to foot the bill, right, for the American military project. How is this going to count? Is the fact that the United States is, you know, paying for all this military as part of some larger Atlantic project, is that going to count as part of the international system? Is that going to count for them? Is that going to count against them? That's a real political question. And because things don't get bogged down in the technical discussions, you can have discussion shift to these more political issues. And then finally, unlike something like capital reserve levels, which is inherently a very locally, organizationally targeted measure, which bank has how much capital, balance of payments is an inherently relational category. When you're talking about balance of payments, you're talking about everything from military expenditure to trade to capital flows to tourism. And so if you want to have a conversation about, say, in 1963, and it's the Italian balance of payments crisis, what you're having a conversation about is what's going on with trade, what's going on with capital, what's going on with all these other things that then may be affecting those things, right? So the discussion always then shifted to larger questions of economic regulation and political economy. So it's a very, very, very different system where we have a much broader discussion of trends and issues under the Bretton Woods system that kept issues of balance of payments at the level of politics and political economy, not technique, and not within the sort of the worldview of one particular kind of approach to policy making. Now, quickly, if we look at since the crisis, there has been recognition among regulators that the roots of the crisis are in global imbalances and perhaps excess liquidity in the global economy. These are real sort of macroeconomic trends. You know, is it countercyclical? Is it pro-cyclical? You know, there's a debate about this, but if you ask that question, what you're really asking about is a question of broader economic processes. But if we look at the kind of practical revisions that are then proposed, and this is still sort of in the works, we see the same sort of elements that we see in the earlier iterations of the Basel Accord. Continued role of private finance in the reform process, the internal ratings-based approach has been modified in the wake of the collapse of the securities market, but still securitizations or resecuritizations, you still get a better rate in terms of risk weighing if you follow the internal ratings-based approach versus the standard approach, right? If you move to this highly sophisticated modeling-based approach. And information and supervision, they've been clear about this, they're still going to delegate this to private and domestic actors. So the overall framework of the system really hasn't changed. So if we ultimately, and we sort of, less in this room, but people who are actually doing this kind of policy making see that crisis is rooted in global macroeconomic dynamics, the problem then is that neoliberal institutional structures are not equipped to deal with these problems. And that's the nature of the beast, so to speak. What this suggests then is that continued reform within this unchanged overall framework will not really address the problem of global financial instability. There's a sort of a larger, I don't want to say systemic, that sounds too broad, but there's a sort of a macro institutional, historical institutional framework that shapes how these organizations operate, and that really seems to be guiding the kind of work that they do and their ability to respond to these crises. All right. Thanks. Yeah, I mean, I realize that's one, I appreciate that. I realize that this sort of one potential problem is that these are really sort of apples and oranges. One thing I'd say, I mean, particularly on this issue of this macro, so as we see the Basel talking about macroprudential regulation, is what are they really talking about? Are they talking about we need to put something in place that will actually regulate something like macroeconomic trends across the global economy, or are they talking about too big to fail, right? If they're talking about too big to fail, which is the sort of structure of corporations in a domestic financial structure and how they'll fail or, you know, whether they'll fail, to me that still fits with the, like, in other words, even within that, I still detect this sort of this similar kind of institutional logic.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And then my second point on that is that to the degree that they're talking about it, my question would be is, do they have the capacity to do anything about it? And here's where, you know, one argument I'd make about Bretton Woods is that, you know, that the standard sort of argument is that Bretton Woods meant that countries didn't have to manage their domestic economies with respect to international pressures. I actually think that's not quite right. If you look at how these negotiations debates went on in the post-war period, there are many instances where countries' domestic policies are being talked about in an international context and being asked to adjust. You know, you need to raise interest rates, right, to cut back on the explosive growth of credit. Right? And those things actually happen. So, for example, in Italy, Right? The Italians have massive growth in their credit market through the early 60s, and it's leading to a huge bounce of payments crisis. And that year, right, the central bank comes in and just turns off the tap, and they just go through a massive, massive monetary tightening. Now, I'm not sure the Basel system has the capacity to do that. And that's my larger point, is that they can talk about it. And as I said, I realize they recognize, the president of the Basel Committee for Bank Supervision talks about liquidity and global imbalances, but it doesn't look like they're actually putting in the mechanisms in place to actually do anything about that, right? Can the Basel Committee go in and say, you know what, you know, United States, you need to do something about the amount of credit you're issuing on private markets, which under Bretton Woods actually could do. Or tried to do.
I found it very, very stimulating, but I also agree with the comment. My question goes to your story about depoliticization and accountability at Basel. And when you make that assertion, I want to ask, well, what would it be like with transnational bank regulation? We had political accountability. And my first blush response is to say that the politicians would come in and relax all the rules even further. Because to the extent you have capital regulation, you have lower rates of returns at banks, and the politicians would say the result is less lending. That's the central bank model, yeah. And it's extended to the global sphere here. And disgrace, though Basel II may be, and I agree with everything you say about it. My sense is that bank regulation would be more of a shambles without it.
Yeah, and I appreciate that point as well. And it's something I've thought about, and not sort of being somebody, you know, I'm much more comfortable, you know, thinking this way than actually thinking about like what the nuts and bolts of actual implementation would actually look like. But I agree with the point, right? The solution, therefore, isn't then to just say, let's just open the works and everybody gets to, like, have their shot at what the system is going to look like. So I guess what I would suggest is that somehow, you know, the structure would work better if there was some capacity for some middle ground between, you know, endless political infighting, right, where everything is, say, open for congressional debate, or some kind of supranational, never-ending debate, versus a kind of, like, let's just deal with this from the inside and have our own sort of project without letting in, views from the outside. The people who write about these, for example, epistemic communities have these debate about this. On the one hand, it's nice that they can form these cohesive views and then sort of impart them upon political officials. On the other hand, it means that they can become too insular and not actually see other sides to the issue. So I'm not sure what it would actually look like, but.
We will take last two comments, Ken and Ken. You can.
Yeah.
One quick question. This kind of goes to a different level. Sort of builds on what was asked last. But one of the interesting things I find is that many of these neoliberal-driven projects are—they talk about risk, but their point really is to give no bad news. In other words, there should always be just good news. For example, you know, if politicians see bank earnings going down, they've got to make sure they go up. In other words, these things are built to create good news all the time. Well, anybody who's got half a brain knows that sometimes you have to deliver bad news. So how difficult would it be for these things to actually adjust so that somebody actually didn't get everything they wanted?
You mean bad news in the sense that it doesn't just lead to some kind of like systemic meltdown where people start, you know,
well, if it's too
running
big,
to the hills? Or
all the two guys who are too big to fail don't want to fail. All the bankers want to make sure that, you know, as you said about the assistant secretary of treasury, damn it, they're taking some of my money away. I want my money back. Everybody wants their money. Everybody wants their everything. Somebody has to lose sometime, right?
I mean, I'm not quite sure if this addresses the question, but, you know, one thing that's interesting when I've looked at it from the perspective of looking at, say, the Bretton Woods system, is, or, and I've also looked at, you know, meetings of the Federal Reserve from the 60s as well, and they're talking about these issues, is they don't talk about individual banks, per se. That sort of shows up in their discussions as sort of, like, anecdotal, like, oh, I heard about this bank, you know. But really what they're talking about is what's the structure of opportunity that the economy affords. Like, is there so much credit that we're seeing these distortions? And so it becomes more about trying to structure the playing field of the market itself rather than what do we do about this one particular institution. So it's less focused on individuals or individual organizations or individual companies and more about what's the picture here within which these companies operate? What are credit market regulations like? How much credit is in the system? What's, you know, what are growth rates? And I realize, you know, economists still talk, I mean, they still talk about these things. But that was really the discussion framing this notion of international regulation.
I was just wondering if you could say a little bit about, now that we're moving forward post-Basel II, in terms of the interaction between the discussion of sort of risk management for banks and capital reserves and what banks can and cannot do in terms of banks or shadow banks. And is that are those interconnected or are those fragmented, discrete discussions at the international level?
Honestly, I'm not really sure. I mean, you know, to the extent that I can sort of get a sense of what the discussion is like at the international level. And, you know, part of it is, of course, part of the asymmetry here is that, you know, the ability to sort of look backwards when you have access to all the information or at least a lot of the information then means it's like you don't get quite the same pictures when you look at the present when you're getting things from things like press releases or sort of anecdotally or from you know, newspaper coverage and things like that. So it, to me, like, so I read it and it sounds fragmented, but then my instinct is to also say, but who really knows, right, until we actually can get inside and see what the real sort of thickness of, so that's my sense, is I sort of feel like it sounds, everything sort of sounds disjointed and it sounds like, you know, like there are ideas all over the place. People are saying this, but then doing this, but I'm also hesitant to want to then jump in and say, aha, this means, though, that they're doing, you know. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. It seems to me, three papers have addressed how markets actually work and as a mode of coordination and how institutions play a role in this work.